asset value prices have to go down. I mean, people still are paying rent. Office occupants are still paying. Apartment occupants are still paying. So the cash flow still continues, but the asset values have to come down, or buyers can't afford to make the numbers work anymore.
Real estate is about freedom, choice freedom, time freedom, and money freedom, and the impact you can make with that freedom. But it doesn't come without cost. Your freedom takes work. That's why Neil Timmons brings together the tools you need to build your real estate legacy, from tips and tricks to interviews with industry titans. It's all here in one place. Real Grit. Let's get to it.
Hey, I got Logan Fulmer here with me today. I'm excited to talk to him. He is a multifaceted dude. He's done a ton on the single family side and the commercial side, gets super creative on some of their dispo strategies. So I'm excited to have him here. Logan, how you doing, man?
Great, Neil. Thanks for having me.
I appreciate you coming on. Thanks. It's fun because I know your background is varied. So it's going to be fun to see where we end up in our conversation today.
Yeah.
Looking forward to it. Well, tell me, we all started someplace. What was your first entry point to real estate?
You know, I inherited a couple bucks and started to flip real estate and realized a couple bucks wasn't enough.
Yeah.
And being younger, the first time I had real money in my pocket, I had a hole in the bottom of my pocket and it went quick. I realized, man, this ain't going to last long. And I went out to the oil field. Buddy of mine helped me get a job to make way more money than I've truthfully ever made in my life. So that was, I got into real estate, and after four flips that made some money. Yeah. This is back in 2009, I guess it was. I got out, went to the oil field for about half a dozen years. So I spent a lot of time working out there, but I'd spend nights and weekends looking at the big cities in Texas, just trying to understand them. And San Antonio is the close one. So I'd come down here and visit and started to realize there was opportunity and started buying land.
Started buying land. So you got out of the oil field, or you started buying land while you were still in the oil business?
Right. Yeah, so yeah. I'm living in the man camp or my RV, depending on what job site I was on. Yeah. And I decided San Antonio is going to be the place. So I came here for a couple weekends, when I had 2 weekends a month, and I'd jog and ride my bike around these areas that I could see, just they looked crummy. And I'd watched East Austin and parts of Houston develop and realize how those neighborhoods turn. And there's this area called Dignity Hill and Denver Heights that were just across the highway from super high value, but these were cheap. I was buying lots for $5,000 and $10,000 a piece.
Wow.
It was actually surprising. And I realized, this is what I looked at. I thought, if the market gets worse, someone will buy these for what I'm into them for. So I shouldn't lose any money. Yep. But if we get big lift and the value crosses the highway, I mean, we're talking home run stuff. So yeah. My downside was very limited, but my potential upside was not really topped out that I could tell.
Yeah, love that.
So that was a good bet. I mean, in that case, I'd go to the oil field and work for a month and come back and buy one or two vacant lots at that price. I was literally no fancy list, no nothing. I'd go jog and walk and knock on people's doors and say, do you want to sell that vacant house next to you?
Yeah.
Or vacant lot next to you. So over the course of a couple of years, I'd built about 24 vacant lots, and it cost me about $300,000 for all of them. And
wow.
Yeah. So about 2014 or 15, and I get a call from this local realtor, and he says, my client wants to offer you $200,000 for this vacant lot that you own. I found you on BCAD or the appraisal district.
Yeah.
I look back in my, before I had QuickBooks, I look back in my spreadsheet and I realized I was in that lot for 10 grand.
And he offered you 200.
200. So This told me a couple things. One of them, the market had moved and I wasn't watching. It moved a lot more than I realized. It also told me that there's a lot more value in this portfolio than I realized. And then also realized I can sell this one and have 70% of my total investment for the 24 lots back. So I sell two lots in the green, but I'd have 20 left. And then the last thing it told me is I wasn't a poor oil field worker anymore.
Wow. Most people don't get the last one, right? They would think I hit a home run, but I'm still in the oil field.
Yeah.
But you took it a different direction. So bring me forward from there. What, at some point you leave the oil field and you're like, I'm in.
So when that happened, instantly I thought, let me buy as many of these lots as I still can before everyone knows the market changed. And I was closing my door in the oil field office and like calling people, cutting deals for lots. And about 6 months later, they came in and laid me off. Price of oil was starting to go down pretty bad. CapEx projects were going down. So I got laid off. And at that point I had a couple bucks in my pocket. So I started doing some small flips, buying more lots. Went down the foreclosure auction and got chatting with people. I made friends with a local CPA who's doing deals on the east side too. We did a couple flips together, and that's how the business actually started. He became my business partner.
Yeah.
We start flipping, And he said, a couple flips, made a couple dollars, but he said, you want me to show you how to really make money? I thought, yeah, we're already doing okay.
What have you been holding out on me?
Right.
Yeah.
So we go down the foreclosure auction and buy three houses for $100,000. So that was $30,000, $40,000 and whatever. And we go put a sign in the yard for sale by owner. And the first one, we bought it for $40,000, sold it for $65,000 for sale by owner, no commission, sold in a couple of weeks. So we didn't do any work. It was just like a wholesale deal, made $25,000. And I thought, oh my goodness, no more remodeling. So that became the model. The goal was to buy something for less than it was worth, not looking at ARV, saying, what's it worth right now? Is it a beat up house we can buy it for less and sell to a flipper? Mm-hmm. Is it a vacant lot we can buy it and sell to a builder? Me and that guy literally became a wholesale shop for about 3 years.
Wow.
That was literally all we did.
That is a beautiful business, by the way.
You're right. And I'd gotten so worn out with the construction.
Yes.
Me, I'm like, this is unbelievable. There's no construction. This is a paperwork game and a financing game. So that's how I grew. And during that time, over on the east side, there were a lot of title problems. And I was passing on these deals that had multiple owners, judgments and liens, breaks in the title chain.
Yep.
And I remember one of the deals I bought without title insurance, and I thought I bought all of it, and I bought 1/9. There were 9 other freaking owners.
Oh, my God.
Now, I was only in it for $5,000, so I thought, I'll try to fix it. So over the next 6 months, I spent researching, finding the owners, figuring out how to do affidavit heirships with them, and I had a lawyer kind of coaching me through it. And that deal was a super smoking deal. And at the end of the year, I remember looking at that one, doing a postmortem review of the year, and said, this is the best deal we did. Why don't we do more? And over the next several years, I spent time just hiring lawyers, paying them hourly, quizzing them, getting help, learning how to fix these title problems. And that actually became one of the pillars of our business, is the curative title work.
That's a section of the business that most investors, like you, very early on are like, forget that. There is too much work there. I don't want to have anything to do with that. And like a shrewd businessman that you are, an entrepreneur leans into those problems, knowing that there's an opportunity there when you can solve them. And kudos to you, because most people go the opposite direction. You've been able to solve a big problem for yourself, and then you solve it for other people too.
Yeah. What was really interesting is there's no competition. So I found that people were buying these lots over here in the house on this side of town, starting to buy them quick, and I couldn't get them super cheap anymore. The market was moving. But I went back and realized no one is buying these houses or lots because they have the problems. So while the market had moved and those $5,000 and $10,000 lots are now 50, 60, 80, or 100 grand, I could still buy them for 20 because they had title problems. So that's how we were still able. This got to be 2018 and 19. We were still able to buy them really cheap. Now it took anywhere from a week to a year to fix the title problems. Yep. But I wasn't having to use hard money. I was paying cash because $5,000 or $10,000.
Correct.
Maybe. So that was the beauty of that. The money went a long way.
You're finding those title issues and you were working on them both in lots and in houses?
Yeah. When you find like, so long downtown in these major MSAs were developed back in the early 1900s. Mm-hmm. And then we had this rural flock where everybody went out to the suburbs and the edges of town where all the new construction was. Yep. And downtowns kind of were vacated. Well, over the last 20 years, folks are coming back to the downtowns and redevelopment was happening. So you have huge subdivisions that were originally developed in the 20s through the 40s. And I mean, they're barren. In particular, downtown San Antonio, one in five tracts of land were vacant lots.
Wow.
That's huge.
Huge.
Yeah. And even the houses, folks would move off and they're dilapidated, vacant. Mm-hmm. We would just look these folks up and call them. And it was literally, do you want to sell me grandma's house that's trash and it was $20,000 in taxes? The answer was always yes. It was never no.
That's amazing. So bring me through, you know, 2000, you know, you hit COVID. What did the world look like for you then?
You know, I remember 2019 and 20, the market started to just get so strong.
Yeah.
And you try to time the market, you know, it's really hard. You got to be really special to do that. And I'm not quite smart enough to do that. But I did know that we're about 10 years into the bull market at that point, and I realized it's near time. So we built some rentals, some notes and stuff like that. And we started selling them all because they were all worth multiples of what we paid and converting mostly into cash. Now, I did that early. We had another 2 years of crazy bull market, and I didn't realize that because COVID was a shakeup. But what it did, it was a stress test that taught me my model was right. Everything I was buying for 50 cents on the dollar or less. And I knew that if the market fell at one point, like it did in 2007, almost overnight, the market could fall by 50% and I could still break even. And I've been telling myself, this is true. This is reality. When COVID happened, inventory was changing quick. People weren't paying for maybe, two or three months. Shit froze. People didn't want to buy. But the neat thing is, instead of me selling it for 90% of what it was worth, I could sell it for 70% of what it was worth. And I could still turn my inventory.
Still churn.
And I realized our stress test worked. So that was really neat during COVID. But It also, at that time, I was starting to switch over because the capital and the credit was really starting to grow at that point. Our office is extreme discipline. We still live off 150 grand a year. That's it. But we're retaining everything except for 150 grand. I can pay my bills, live like a damn king with no debt on that. And we started to look at a little bit bigger assets. We do the curative title work on a lot downtown San Antonio that was $100,000 or $50,000 lot. And I realized this happens in Dallas, Houston, and Austin. So you do the same work on a lot downtown Austin or Houston, but that lot sells for 500 grand to $1 million. And you're still buying it 20 cents in the dollar, doing the same work here. It's just 10 times the money.
Yes.
So we started to apply that to downtown lots, ranches. We were finding some commercial that was in the same situation and just started to develop the curative title work. But that's what led us into the different asset classes.
Okay. Yeah. So ultimately, you get into different asset classes, not just lots, but now you're into other assets, right? The commercial asset classes.
Yeah. And you would think that that type of distress doesn't exist, but you know, apartment complex, we contracted for $1 million, is worth $2 million. It was behind on taxes. The owner lived in California. The property manager locally was stealing from him. Yep. And it was a tertiary market. So it wasn't destroyed by all the funds buying everything yet. And then, so that was our first apartment deal. That was paid $1 million. It was worth $2 million right off the bat. And then a warehouse bought for $1.5 million. The man that owned it sold the business out of it to another guy. The business wasn't performing well, but he kept the real estate. Well, the tenant was behind on taxes because the lease was, you know, responsibility, behind on taxes, behind on rent payments. And the owner had started getting into some alcoholism and poor life choices, and he didn't want to go sue the tenant. So we were able to buy the $3.2 million warehouse for about $1.5 million. We spent $100,000 on legal fees, and it took 6 or 8 months to get the ding-dong tenant out, clean out the site. But instantly, we sold it for a little more than double what we paid.
Wow.
It took 9 months to do that, but we sat on it for 366 days. So we get in the capital gain tax
treatments. Yep. Yep. You don't need a short-term gain at $1.5 million or just a little better than that. Yeah. No, incredible.
So another interesting model to that is once we started to see these commercial assets transact, I've been doing some deals with a guy named Kyle, and his background was wholesaling, and we bought from wholesalers, but I'd never thought about doing it. Kyle comes in one day and says, "Hey, I don't know if you know how good I was at wholesaling." I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Well, the first 12 months I was wholesaling for my cubicle at work part-time." It was his first 16 months. He netted almost $1 million.
Oh my God.
And I'm like, "What the fuck are you talking about, dude?
Why are you still in a cubicle, bro?"
Yeah. So he left that cubicle job, came to work with me, and I said, "Let's build a business. If you did that by yourself, let's train people to do this and build something bigger." So that's how our wholesaling business happened. And this month, our wholesaling business is 13 months old.
13 months old. It's a wholesaling business. What type of assets is the wholesaling business focused on?
Pretty much commercial income assets. So apartments less than 50 units is the bread and butter, but we routinely get 100 to 150 unit. Mm-hmm. Sometimes there'll be the warehouse stuff in there. But if it's in a market that's too far away from us that we don't want to own and manage, we'll wholesale those. But it's really commercial income assets.
Commercial income producing assets, largely apartments. 80%+ of your business, it's fair to say, is apartments.
On the wholesale, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. All right. So you presumably are seller direct, get a deal locked up, just like you in a house. There's no difference between this process and a house and a commercial asset, right?
Theoretically, correct. Now,
yeah.
There are actually a couple interesting differences. Wholesaling a house, you can do that with no earnest money, $100. When you're doing $1 million deal, it's 10 grand earnest money.
Yep.
Plus, you might have to get a phase one and you might have to do some inspections. So in some of those deals, we'll spend $5,000 to $8,000 in hard costs that we can't get back.
Yeah.
So there's a little more expense and that's a lot longer contract timing.
That's tied to your due diligence component, right? So if you had infinite, that became a function of you've got a tight window in order to complete due diligence. Otherwise, if you could extend it, you could push some of those costs, not the earnest money, but the rest of the costs onto the end buyer to do a phase one or an inspection.
Right. But since you don't have a lot of time, we said,
correct,
this is a good deal and we know it. Pay for the stuff to move it up.
You can compress your time frame, contract to close then as a result.
Now, the tough part is, you know, I looked at a report a couple months ago. We had about $350,000 in earnest money across all the deals out. So we had a lot. And we were buying phase ones and sending and doing property video tours and pictures and stuff on properties that didn't sell. So on a deal that doesn't sell, depending on how our gauge is, we might have $1,000 in sunk cost or we might have $4,000 or $5,000 in sunk cost. But those assignment fees on the commercial deals, think about this for a minute. On a $1 million deal, 6% would be the realtor fees. That's 60 grand. Let's grow that a little bit to 10% because it's not a big difference. But if you can peel off a 10% assignment fee on a $1 million deal, it's not much more than realtors make, but it's 100 grand. So now you extrapolate that out to a $2 million deal and the person actually gave you a pretty good discount. We did a deal 3 months ago in Garland, Texas on a 20,000 square foot warehouse. We contracted it for 2 million. We sold it for 2.6. The difference was we netted 580,000 is what the net wound up being because the buyer paid his own broker commission on it.
The buyer paid his own broker commission on that type of deal. On a standard deal, you're going to wholesale this off. You're utilizing brokers primarily to wholesale it off.
So when we sell them,
yeah,
if it's an area that we have a really built out buyer's list and yeah, we know the brokers in the area, we call like that. If not, we have to spend a fair amount of time canvassing the public records for the brokers that transact that stuff.
Yeah.
And then we'll call them as our dispo agent, basically. And
what do you end up paying a broker there?
3% standard rate.
3%. You're just shaving off the other three in terms of a listing broker. It's not being listed. You guys are carving that piece off.
Yeah
and I'm with you.
Sometimes the buyer's agent or the buyer will actually pay their broker. So our fee stays the same. The buyer pays it. But if we need to pay it sometimes, we'll do it. We're happy to.
Have you been to the vault? RealGritVault.com. Listen, we've got multiple guests who come on and oftentimes they bring us little tips, tricks, tools, scripts, Excel calculators, a multitude of things, and they share it. They share it for you. You can get them totally free, totally free. RealGritVault.com. Never been on the show who's brought everything. It's all behind the vault. Get it. RealGritVault.com.
Well, I get you. Sign me up all day and twice on Sunday to make 500 grand if I had to pay a broker, right?
Right.
Yeah. It's about net dollars at the end of the day.
Yeah. The neat thing is the broker wants the deal done because they want to get paid too.
Correct.
So it's interesting in residential real estate, if you're wholesaling, as soon as they say, I'm going to call a broker, an agent, a lawyer, you're like, oh crap, my deal's about to bomb. In this case, as soon as a broker or a lawyer gets involved, they want to get paid.
Fair to say, I've been preaching this for some time, even growing out of the brokerage industry on the residential side and having a lot of exposure on the commercial side today. The brokers on residential and commercial are not the same.
Yeah.
Not even close, right? Is that fair to say?
Very. You are dead right there.
And especially when it comes to investments, wholesales, the ability to put a deal together and want to get it done, want to get to the finish line, it's still not the same.
Yeah. I think the big difference, A, they're more sophisticated.
Yes.
When you're getting 3% on a $200,000 house, you got to do a lot of those. When you're getting 3% on a $2, $3 million building, that buyer, that broker is getting paid real money. He correct, wants this to go down.
Yes, you're exactly right about that. The market's changing. We're at a spot where there's still a lot of demand for these commercial producing assets, specifically in the apartments sector specifically, but the environment's changing a little bit. Where do you see things right now? I mean, is anything playing out in your world as you're seeing this as you wholesale? And where do you see things going?
It's hard for me. I'm not smart enough to forecast where it is going. But I will tell you that with the interest rates going up, financing is getting different. Buyers are having to put more money down. I will tell you that almost all these assets that we're selling are getting financing with the buyers. That's common. So their rates are going up. Time to close the loan is extending. We're having to give more concessions to get the deals done. Last month, the month before last, we did see some pretty heavy pullback. That month was much slower than any month we've ever had. This month, a lot more deals are closing now. But we're having to work much harder to find the buyers that are actually performing and are legitimate. Our dispo used to toss something out and just the piranhas would gobble it. Our dispo is having to work their butt off to keep sales right now.
Yeah.
And I suspect by the end of this year, mortgage rates are 7 or 8% right now. I bet we see 10% by the end of this year. And that will affect it. Now, at the end of the day, folks want to put their money to work. When you're talking about these kind of investors, they still are going to keep doing this. This is their job. They're not part-timers. So I think they're still going to be transacting. It's going to look different for sure. I don't know how, but we are watching literally by the week. We're watching our reports, keeping track of buyers and figuring out what's happening because shift is happening quick. And I don't want to get consumed and not catch it.
With that in mind, go back to, 2019, 2020. You were at a spot where you're buying things at 50 cents on the dollar, right? The idea being as the market churned, you'd still be able to churn inventory. And then COVID happened. You had a real life stress test for the business model and it passed with flying colors to go, I can survive this. And then if you can survive, you can thrive because our competition just gets diminished, right? What are your thoughts internally about stress testing the current model on a forward-looking basis, knowing that or believing that interest rates are rising, continue to rise?
I think there's a gap. Like, I think a lot of folks have talked about this. I think it's natural to believe this. Kind of like when you're casting the fishing pole, you know, it's real loose, and then all that slack pops out of it.
Yeah.
The buyers right now understand there's a difference and they're adjusting. The sellers haven't felt that yet because they're not selling 20 assets. They have this one they've owned forever and they don't know the offers are going away. So we're making lower offers to folks and we're not getting as much traction as we had. Mm-hmm. So I completely believe that slack will snap in the next couple months because the offers vanish. So now the buyers are going to have to get more real, or the sellers are going to have to get more realistic with us. So I believe we're going to see that. Outside of that, asset value prices have to go down. I mean, people still are paying rent. Office occupants are still paying. Apartment occupants are still paying. So the cash flow still continues, but the asset values have to come down or buyers can't afford to make the numbers work anymore.
You can't borrow at 7% and still make the numbers work on last year's prices when you could borrow at 3.5% last year.
So our discipline has been good. We retain a lot of earnings. We're very careful. When we get a big lick, we're not going to buy a Ferrari. We're putting the money back in the bank. And I've told our team and our other partners, hey guys, if we break even for the next 3 or 4 months, I don't really care. I just don't want to give back any of the retained earnings. So our goal is to make money, but my real goal is to break even for the next 3 or 4 months and just watch what the hell's happening. Stay afloat, watch. That's not sexy. So a lot of people don't want to talk about that. Everybody says, I want to grow by 3 times, whatever. Just trying to break even for the next few months, man. We've had a good run.
Yeah. Well, you know what? During times of recession, you know, the competition goes away. I've always said, you know, we don't compete against the market. We compete against other players in the market. As the landscape changes, there are opportunities every day of the week. It's just a matter of getting yours, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I don't know how that all is going to look. One thing I will tell you, though, is we're getting a lot more buy opportunities on the industrial stuff. We are starting to see that happen. And this is, so I'm at 41 years old right now. And we've been building cash and credit for the last, I don't know, 7 or 8 years. And now I think is the time where we're going to start deploying that for some more lifetime assets.
Yeah. Talk to me what your team looks like and the structure. You've got a big machine. You got to have a number of bodies to be able to operate that thing. What's that look like?
We do. So, gosh, I have to count. I think we have 16 folks in the operation. So me and the original guy that started the company, you call us the managing partners. And then we have Bill, Kyle. Then we have 4, I guess what I would call junior partners, maybe. Mm-hmm. We brought them in and started companies with them. So they each run their own companies. And then me and my original business partner have our hands in all of them. And then we supply the legal, the accounting, all the other support services, building, and help mentorship and grow those individual businesses with the owner operators.
Yeah.
So we've got 2 attorneys. One of them bills 80% of his time to us. And the other one is just flex when he requires this like real litigation. The other one does our docs, our negotiations. That's really important when we're doing these messy deals. He's involved in everything with us.
Sure.
And then we've got 12 people on the production side. So I'd call that acquisition, disposition, transaction coordinating, clerical.
It's a lot of TC work that goes into those, well, to all deals, but I can only imagine on the curative side and then also on the commercial side, there's a lot of pieces there.
You know, on the curative side, that almost ends up being more project management work. But on the wholesale and the commercial stuff, I mean, you're getting leases, ordering inspections, reports, coordinating. There is a boatload of TC work on that.
Yeah. It's really incredible. What's been the most challenging, you know, looking back over the course of your real estate career, what's been the most challenging aspect of it?
Probably discipline and not knowing what's coming next. So, the moment you get a big paycheck, everybody's got to win. And you really want to spend it. I mean, you got the money in your account to go buy something super cool. And you got to say, oh, there's going to be a rainy day and I need to be able to weather the storm. So living on discipline has been tough to do. But right now we feel so good about it. The other thing is every time we find new opportunities or things change, you have to have the confidence and the comfortable feeling to know that you're going to be okay and go the right direction as it shifts. Even though you don't know the answer at the time. So for example, I told you earlier when we were chatting, there was about 2 years, where we'd go to the foreclosure auction, buy a house and sell it on MLS and make $20,000 or $30,000 and not do any work. That was my favorite, easiest time in this whole thing. That was great. But I also knew that wasn't going to last. And we started to have this attrition where we'd go to the foreclosure auction and the house we bought for $30,000 was $35,000, $38,000, $40,000. And I'd start losing auctions like crap. I could see it vanishing in front of us and I didn't know what to do. Those were the times where I thought those were the tougher, I guess, mind game. And the neat thing is, because we have several partners here, everybody's bright and hardworking. And we'd sit down and say, crap, what are we going to do? And one guy says, I got an idea. Let's door knock on these foreclosures before the foreclosure auction.
Mm-hmm.
So we were doing that before a lot of folks in our market were doing it. Yeah. Couldn't get them at the auction. So that was kind of a pivot. And then all of a sudden, we were one of the first people to call and do that here. Then it got to the point where we were calling people right after the foreclosure postings, and they'd say, I already sold it. And I thought, oh, crap. Now this is saturated. So there's been model changes like that every 6 to 12 months. Those have been the challenges to figure out, where am I going to go? And when we turn, when we start out, it's like a jet ski, it just turns like this. Well, as things grew, now you're starting to turn like a bigger boat.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's like a damn barge. You don't switch like that so quick.
No, you're exactly right. What's the old saying? If you want to go fast, go alone. You want to go far, go together.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly right. I actually would attribute that type of saying to folks, to a lot of our success in terms of the financial stability. When you're going to get a credit line at a bank with one guy who's got a good business, you get your credit line. When you go in there with five guys that are personally guaranteeing that and five collective companies' revenue, you get a big credit line.
That's right.
But everybody has to buy in the fact that what we're building together is going to be far larger. Your share of what we build together is going to be far larger than one thing you'd own by yourself. And we've worked really hard to pick like-minded folks, which I believe that really attributes to the success of this machine as it grows.
How do you end up managing that thing? Keeping a singular focus, knowing that we're building something bigger than us as individuals. We're building collectively something really big, really something cool and special. How do you get people to buy into that, that vision?
You know, there's a high level of accountability. Early on, I would meet folks and I would listen to their personality, their behaviors. I'd listen to their financial acumen, and I'd start to build this profile of a person. I was always looking for another good business partner. But every once in a while, I'd say, well, that guy stands out to me. He's hardworking. He's really smart. I can tell he's making good money, but he's not driving a Lambo or whatever. And all these things would start to build up. And I'd say, let's go do some deals together. And kind of, it's almost like dating. So we would really spend a lot of time doing that. But I remember when I'd pitch, I'd say, all right, I would like to try to build a business with you, but there's this level of accountability that I say, man, it's part of my responsibility that if we build this together, you're betting on me to help you be more successful than you would be on your own. Mm-hmm. I'm making a promise to somebody, and now I have big shoes to fill. I have to do what I said I was going to do. And there's a high level of accountability with both sides. But the neat thing is, they're coming to me with parts of the business that they don't have or they can't solve on their own. And as long as I unlock that for them, I've done what I said I was going to do. So it's no different than finding a wife. It really is. I'm going to do something for you that you can't do for yourself. You're going to do that for me. Mm-hmm. And we're in this together. We joke about it. This is really like having five wives. They're all dudes. But this really is like a marriage. We're building a business that we...
You have to have a shared focus, a shared vision, and you put extreme trust and confidence in another person.
That's it. You know, I hear about businesses falling apart all the time. We have open financials. Everybody looks at their books all the time. You got to know that guy's not going to steal from you. He's going to make decisions to preserve your equity and care about you too. And that's a high level of accountability. Thank goodness that we've never had a financial bomb yet with a partner, but those are risks.
Yep, there's no doubt about that. Well, let's do this. I want to move on to the final segment, what I call 4-4 Impact.
4-4 Impact.
Your favorite quote, bet on yourself or any other bet is against you. And I'm not going to do that. You said it. What about that resident? Where did that come? What was the genesis of that quote?
The guy that I hired in the oil field to help support my division got promoted to an equal and then above me without me knowing. And he came in and laid me off one day. And I remember walking out of there thinking, what am I going to do? I can go get hired in the oil field again. I remember thinking, I was in these meetings with these guys. They were more experienced and had more years, more miles on the tires than me. Mm-hmm. But I remember thinking, these guys aren't smarter than me. I work more hours than them. And I just thought, do I go get the other job or do I bet on me? Let me do this.
Yeah.
I found that people start businesses and they don't know what's going to happen. But I remember thinking, I'm starting this business. I'm working more hours. I'm actually making less money in the beginning, but I realized I was willing to do whatever, anything, because it was my thing. So I realized betting on me instead of going back and putting my faith in somebody else was what I felt obligated to myself to do that.
Entrepreneurs are the only breed of humans are going to work twice as hard for themselves just so they don't have to work half as much for somebody else.
And in the beginning for half money.
That's exactly right. Yeah, you're totally right about that. What do you think holds most investors back from hitting their personal next level?
Oh, this is an easy one, actually. I spent some time in the Hamptons with some of my brother-in-law earlier this year. And in the last year and a half, this really affirmed some things for me. The mindset thing, I've always heard people talk about, it sounds like a cliche. I met a guy, built a close relationship with him in Arizona. He is a very successful guy, built a big business from nothing in literally 36 months. I'm talking, it's just so impressive. And he doesn't work harder than me. He's not smarter than me. We're both very similar people. And he just said, we built a model and I just hired a bunch of people and did it. And I'm like, what? I realized it's how he thought about the thing. And then, so I started to buy into that and he helped coach me along the way. Out of the thoughts that I had in my head that I thought could be possible, he said, you just go do them. And he's right. I just started doing them and our entire portfolio of companies doubled revenue in 12 months because I just started doing what I wanted to do, what I believe could happen.
I'll summarize it differently. What I hear you saying is that people just overthink it.
You're scared. You don't think you're capable of it. Go do it. You'd be surprised. You can do 10 times what you think you can. About, I don't know, 3 or 4 months ago, we spent some time, like I was telling about in the Hamptons, some of the wealthiest people in the world probably.
Absolutely.
And I remember being around these guys and ask them, how'd you get here? What idea was it that took you here? What sets you apart from other people? And I had the same feeling. These guys aren't smarter than me. They're not working harder than me. They just doubled down on what they believed in and they really went all in and they just kept doing it. And in that moment, we've gotten some really good success in the last couple of years. But I remember thinking, this is my place. These are my people. Yeah. I'm going to be here. Maybe not that specific zip code, but my version of that is coming if I keep doing this. Yeah. And I realize it's all here.
Outside of real estate, what are you most passionate about?
I hang out with my family and I exercise and I work. Those are the three things that I do. I don't do anything else. I got 4 kids. Yeah. So me and my wife are busy. We got a 12-year-old, an 11-year-old, a 3-year-old, and a 2-year-old.
Oh, you're real busy, brother. Yeah.
You know, it's such a great family, man. We spend time with them. We exercise and we come to work. That's it. That's I love all three of those.
What's your favorite way to make an impact in the community?
So we do spend a lot of time with our kids and their activities, but I think we started to give back in terms of sharing what we've learned. And it's interesting. Business has grown from that, but we love what we do. We love talking about it and we start sharing it with people. We go out to dinner. We share it with them. We meet someone. I helped a guy at HEB who was trying to push the chips, the guy at the end cap. And he's like, have this sample. And I'm like, dude, you didn't try to push me on these chips. He's like, what are you talking about? So me and my daughter talked to this guy for 10 minutes on how to ask person what they like, ask them if they like that, if they would buy that, give them the samples, find out which one they like the most and hand them 3 bags and close them.
Yeah.
And just sharing this stuff out there is so fun because you see a light go off in people's head. The guy learned how to sell out all of his chips at the end cap at HEB.
What's hilarious about that is you teach a man, learns how to do that, change your life forever.
That's right.
You learn how to be a salesperson, not an order taker, change your life.
Yep, you're right. There are a ton of folks we spend time doing JV deals with. We don't make any money around here, but it's just so neat sharing this because you see something change in their head and you realize that person's not the same anymore.
Yep, that's right. Hold them.
Yeah.
Dude, I'll tell you what, you got a fun story. It's crazy to hear about how you came out of the oil fields and you identified a change and an opportunity and knowing that your risk was asymmetric, meaning limited downside, giant upside, and struck it. Find yourself in an incredible curve in our business environment and then built a business around it and continue to pivot.
You know, we're buying non-real estate businesses. We're investing all kinds of stuff. And that same concept applies. And I talked to a lot of guys. And the message that they have is wrong. They look at it. I'll use a flip house, for example. They look at the flip house and they say, I'm going to make 30 grand. That's what they're focusing on. And I always try to spin the narrative for them because this is the same concept we apply to all of our investments, our businesses. Let's help you figure out how to manage all of your risks so you can't lose any money.
Correct.
If you can't sell it for as much as you hope, you got to manage that risk. If it costs more to repair than you expected, you got to manage that risk. All these things, if you manage that risk down so far, what ends up happening is your margin of safety or your profit margin, it's actually the same thing. It just behaves differently depending on what's happening. When folks start to look at that difference, then they realize they're protecting their capital. And if you protect your capital at all costs, you're going to wind up with a lot of profit in your deals. And that concept, we applied it to the vacant lots, to the foreclosures, to the commercial stuff, even to the non-real estate business we're investing in. If we're protecting that capital, you can dang it. I'd buy a truckload of freaking pins.
Correct.
If it was right.
Figure out how to set yourself up so you can't lose. That's what you've been able to do. It sounds like that's the focus on the businesses and that will ultimately weather any storm to be able to get through. Right.
You know, That said, I think real estate investing is going to be interesting in the next 10 years because now Wall Street is looking at single family housing like an asset class.
Yes.
If you go to YouTube, Facebook, all these venues on the internet, you can learn how to be a pretty damn good investor. You can learn how to wholesale for free on the internet now. This is now in the hand of the common person who's willing to watch 60 hours worth of footage on the internet.
Correct.
And I think that's why you have so many wholesalers. There are more single 50 house, single family home, like investment owners. One guy owns 50 single family houses. There are more of those today than there have ever been in history.
Correct.
Because this knowledge is going to everybody. This is a fun time to be in real estate and in business, but I think it's turning the heat up quick.
Yeah.
I'm curious to see where that goes, but you got guys, I don't know how long you've been in real estate, but I've only been at 10 years. We've gotten huge amounts of information in such short amounts of time. The next 10, 20 years will be really interesting.
It's going to be interesting. It's going to be interesting to see. There's a lot of people who are short-sighted. So I was in it in 2004 as a broker, as an agent on the residential side. So the bumps through 2008 actually set me up for a lot of success, then eventually entering into the investment side of things.
So you're particularly transactional during that time.
During that time, yeah.
And your income was coming from fees, not the equity.
That's exactly right.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah. So I didn't end up getting into the investment side till post 08.
What made you shift from the broker side to the principal?
Ultimately, a multitude of things. But to summarize it in the easiest way, what I was doing then wasn't going to get me to where I wanted to go.
And you were probably seeing all these deals and saying, whoa, I want some of that.
Yeah. You know, that was a piece of it. Yes. But it's ultimately a lifestyle piece to going, you know, where do I want to be 5, 10, 15, 20, 30 years from now? And to be a guy out schlepping houses at 8 p.m. fiddling with lockboxes was a firm hell no. Like, not gonna happen. Right. And so it required a change.
Now, did you completely stop the brokerage side then?
Good question. So we still have a brokerage. I'm the manager of a brokerage. A friend of mine owns it. Actually, I've been here 6 years or so. I stopped selling. I got into fix and flip, wholesale, morphed into commercial about 4 years ago. And so we fix and flip out of the office today, which I'm not largely involved in the way we've got it set up. And my time is focused on the commercial side of things. About 2 years ago, almost, I brought an agent on in to completely replace me on the brokerage side. I largely stopped doing stuff. I would still list our flips. And then I brought her over so I never had to go to another house again.
Wow.
And then just leverage up at some point, right? I mean, you think about trading time for dollars. Like, there's a reason I don't mow the yard and I don't clean the house. Not only because I hate it, but also because at some point you cannot justify doing $15, $20, $25, $30 an hour tasks. And at some point, being a realtor, doing even whatever it may be, $300, $400, $500 tasks, when you found out you can employ your dollars, your time more efficiently, it needs to get employed more efficiently. The most valuable people in the world, the billionaires, focus their time on the highest value, highest revenue generating activities, even to the point where it makes what you and I do today look silly about what they focus their time on, right?
So I went through a phase about 2, maybe 3 years ago where I began to intentionally focus on that. I actually struggled. Did you struggle when you went through that transition, or was it like, I'm done with that crap? Was it easy?
Oh, when we brought Ashley on, she's a realtor. I brought everybody into the office and I had champagne. And what was billed as celebrating her coming on, taking this over, which was true. At the same time, I knew in my mind, which I never told anybody, it's going, the old me just died right there.
Nice. Okay. Mm-hmm. It was to the point where you were ready.
Yeah. Well, I knew what was required of me in order to move forward. And so part of that is, and you hit on it, is how do you just move from what's up here to going what's here? What do you actually get done? Taking those ideas out and making them tangible. And sometimes the leaning into those things that are the scariest oftentimes catapult us forward the fastest, the most. Growth is on the other side of uncomfortable. So how do you lean into the uncomfortable?
That's exactly right. There was a little trouble that I had with that because I thought, like every other idiot out there, that the way I did it was perfect.
And nobody could do it better, right?
Right. And that's so
I get it. Yeah, right.
But it was hard starting to let those assignments go. But I'll tell you, today is really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. No, there's no doubt about it. It's sometime that was an easy one for me, but there are other pieces of the business. You're like, how do I just give that up? How do I go through there? Yeah. That's the way to scale through it. You got to replace yourself and two people at 80% of how good you are is better than one of you.
You know, that's been a common theme recently. I've got a real estate coaching program And initially I thought this is going to be about the deal. And I just started to feel it out because guys said, hey, I respect what you're doing. I'd like to get you to help me. And I said, let's do a group that does that. And I didn't really know where this was going to go.
Yeah.
Then the first couple of weeks, I started to realize this guy's got to hire an administrative assistant. This guy's got to rent an office. This guy's got to hire a couple people to work on his lead gen. And I remember a couple guys saying, what the heck, man? We're not talking about real estate. I'm like, what are you kidding me? I'm helping you build your real estate business. They were deal junkies. They lived and died by the deal. And in a short amount of time, they're starting to realize, oh, I can build an operation.
That's good to get your first deal. That's good for a handful of deals, right? But at some point, there's enough flow and you're going, if you don't solve the things that you just hit on, if you don't build the business, the ebbs and flows are wild. They are extreme.
One of the guys I was talking to, and this was one of the most elementary parts of it. I asked him what he was doing while we were talking. He was driving to go mow. This guy had made about 700 grand in net profit that year. And he was driving to go mow a yard at one of the mobile homes he's about to sell. Mm-hmm. First step with him wasn't even to hire people. It was to get subcontractors to do the dang work.
Correct.
Oh my goodness. That blew me away. That was the worst.
But sometimes it's just, and I'm guilty of it at times too. Just get out of your own way.
Yeah.
Get out of your own way. And then all of a sudden, growth is not that hard.
Strangely enough, you're right. You know, I didn't want to pay folks to help me early on because I was small-minded and cheap. But I realized getting someone to force me to make those changes, even paying them $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 was huge. Yeah. And it's neat because now in the coaching program, I'm able to force that down some guy's throat. And even they get mad at me sometimes. Yeah. But in a 90-day period, we can look back and it's substantial at what it's changed.
Well, you got to hit that switch. It's not a cost, it's an investment. And that means the time I didn't do that now needs to get allocated to something else that produces way more than what I just spent.
Yeah. You know, I used to look at these whole coaching things and say, man, this is a bunch of BS. All these rich guys just trying to suck money from the newbies. And there are a lot of them that are like that.
Sure.
God, I realize you can pick years of a person's experience in 20 minutes and get so much better.
Yeah, no, I agree.
The next best way would be like to download all the info.
And yes.
Yeah. They haven't figured that out yet. So we'll do coaching until then.
So we'll do it then. Yeah. Speaking of that, so people want to find you, they want to follow you, they want to connect with you. What can they do? Where can they go?
Yeah. So the Real Estate Junkie is my Instagram handle and Logan Bentley Fulmer on Facebook. I'll send you the link. So maybe when this gets live, we can add it in there.
It'll be in the show notes.
But, you know, in the last probably 3 or 4 months, I really spent a lot of time putting short form content on Instagram. Mm-hmm. So people can get a lot of the good information in a short amount of time, because on Facebook, we spend a lot of time narrating it. And it's just takes a lot of work.
Yep. No, good. Well, we'll make sure we get those down. And Logan, I appreciate you taking the time to connect up here. It's a fun conversation. I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, it's my hobby and my job. So that is really neat when they kind of do this together.
Yeah, no, it's deep passion. It's not work then anymore, is it?
No, it's not. You know, we put together this retirement plan so that we can have fixed income, that we don't have to come to work, have this stark reality that if I don't do this, I'm probably going to start dying. Yes. And at 41 years old, it sounds crazy to say that. I realize that's true. I'm going to have to do this for the rest of my life.
Yeah. No, I understand that.
Are you the same way?
Yeah. Yes. It's because of here. Your wheels get spinning. You love it. It's so much fun.
There's a local real estate investor that built a 400 house portfolio here in Bexar County. And he retired and moved to the beach and did what he said he's always going to do.
Yeah.
And in 90 days, he came back and said the beach was boring.
Yeah. I know. I believe it. Logan, we're going to let's do this in a year. Let's see where things are at. Take a pulse of the market and where you're at, where I'm at. That'd be great.
I love that. That's a great idea.
Yeah.
That's a great idea.
We'll make sure we get it on the schedule.
Tim, thanks for having me on, man. I appreciate it. This was really fun going through this stuff.
Enjoy it, Logan. Thanks a nut. I appreciate it. Hey, for everybody here, Real Grit, I'm Neil Timmons, reminding you that real estate requires real grit. I'll see you next time.
If you like our content and want more, you can access it at realgritpodcast.com. You hear it guest after guest. Instinctively, you already know it. But let me call it out. The most expensive action is inaction. The real estate market is full of opportunities. You just need to uncover them. You can build a business that lasts for years, makes monumental impact in the lives of those that you love. It's not just about business, but about the freedom you get because of it. Have you ever heard the saying, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. I believe that partnering is essential. In fact, I partner with hardworking investors all the time. The point is that you can get a lot further with the right partner. Let me say it again, the right partner. If you've ever thought about partnering with anyone, or if you have a partner now, I encourage you to download my free Partner and Profit Guide, which includes the top 5 must-answer questions to evaluate a profitable partnership. You can find it at www.legacyimpactpartners.com. I'll see you in the next episode.
Hey, it's Neil Timmons. I've got a question for you. Are you a fix and flipper and want to leverage your skills, build passive income, create bigger paydays? Maybe you buy and hold rental houses and you want to increase your income by working less. Maybe you're executing on the Burr methodology and times being what they are, you're finding more cash locked into a deal. Maybe you want more predictable profits, or maybe this is your first go at real estate. Well, I've got a challenge for you. The 20X Profit Challenge. It's hosted and taught by yours truly. I'm going to teach and show you over the course of 5 days in this totally free challenge how to 20X your profit. Lesson one's a game changer, multiplying your income and capital fast. Lesson two is the perfect plan. I'm going to show you how to be getting off-market 20X profit deals coming to you. The cash flow multipliers, lesson three, how to rapidly force appreciation and income growth. Lesson four is the deal accelerator, buying and holding profit guarantee properties. And lesson five, the wealth accumulator, consistently closing on 20X profit deals. I'm going to show you exactly my methodology, exactly what I did to go from where I was at, not achieving the results I wanted to achieve in my life, not achieving that passive income that I hoped for, that I knew I was capable of, and in 3.5 years, becoming financially free. I'm going to do that in a 5-day free challenge. To sign up, go to 20xprofitchallenge.com, 20xprofitchallenge.com. We've got one coming up. Go there now, register, it's totally free, 20xprofitchallenge.com, and I'll see you in the challenge.